Good afternoon. I'm opening up the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for Thursday, February 26, and I'm going to open up a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measures, and I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 2960, dated February 13th, 09. LC 2359, dated February 10th, 09. LC 3289, dated February 23rd, 09, LC 2080, dated February 12th, 09, and LC 3115-1, dated the 23rd of February, 09.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves all of those LCs. Do I have to repeat them all? Hopefully not.
The aforementioned.
As aforementioned, be introduced as committee bills, and colleagues, just a reiteration that introduction of committee bills doesn't necessarily mean you're supporting the content of those committee bills, but just for the purposes of introduction. Is there any discussion?
Whoa.
Is there any objection?
Whoa.
What do you mean? We do 40 in your committee.
If not,
I think she's trying to catch up.
Yeah. If not, these measures are introduced as committee bills. I will close the public hearing, the work session for introduction of committee bills. And
Madam Chair, before you start, Senator Atkinson over there has a very nice Lego set. Does he have to share?
He will be. Okay. He's going to share with the whole committee.
Okay.
And since we're still waiting for one member, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 108. And then we're going to do a work session and then open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 472, because we have a lot of people here for that today. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 108. Beth, can you please read the bill for us?
Senate Bill 108 requires that students participating in the diagnosis and treatment of animals are engaged in an approved educational program by the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board.
Okay, thank you. And with that, I will take the list for testimony. We have a short list, but first we're going to have Lori Mannequin, Executive Director. Mackinan, did I say that right? Executive Director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, come up and talk about the bill. Okay, if you have a pager, cell phone, BlackBerry on, that's what that noise is, so please turn it off.
We vote no.
Yeah. Yes. Madam Chair, we have to check the cell phones at the door.
We could do as some of the chairs do. You have to contribute to the Common School Fund if yours goes off during the committee. So welcome. And, oh, there we go, Common School Fund. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Mr. Vice Chair and committee members. I'm Lori Mackinan, Director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, and I'm here also with Dr. Clark from Oregon State University and Glenn Kolb from the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. Senate Bill 108 attempts to plug up a hole in our statute that we discovered as a result of a complaint about a veterinarian who had a first-year veterinary student working in his practice, doing surgeries, administering rabies, doing these things at times unsupervised. And the board disagrees that this veterinarian or any veterinarian can have a veterinary student working in a practice unless that student is part of an externship or affiliated with an accredited school or with Oregon State University. By the licensee's interpretation of our statute, any of you could call yourself a student of veterinary science and start practicing on animals in the state. So what this bill does is plug up that hole, make sure that a student who is working in a veterinary clinic is part of an approved or accredited program.
Okay. And do you want to talk about the Dash 1 amendments? Because I think you actually proposed those.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. The Dash 1 amendments merely add language that ensures that a College of Veterinary Medicine accredited by the American Veterinary Medical Association is part of the language. It removes Oregon State University in subparagraph A and substitutes a College of Veterinary Medicine accredited by the American Veterinary Medical Association.
And I had a question when I read through this bill is how many instances, I mean, you talked about one, but is this something that you are seeing more frequently?
Madam Chair, members, As far as we know, there has only been the one instance, and we learned of it because a relief vet working in the clinic called and was concerned that this student was practicing veterinary medicine, basically without a license. So in order, you know, we want to see the OVMA mentorship program succeed and other programs that might come into place, but we want to make sure that those programs are legitimate programs and that not any person claiming to be a student of veterinary science has the right to work in a clinic.
Okay. Right. Are there questions for the panel from the committee? Senator Boquist.
As you indicated, this has only apparently happened once, and you did mention it was a student that it happened with, so could you tell us what the student was and what community they were from? And then the second thing, if I recall correctly, OSU doesn't have a full vet program. We have to send them to the state of Washington to do part of their work. Could you elaborate on the full range of programs we actually have and why we picked OSU and in addition to the board?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I can answer part one of your question. It was a student from Oregon State University who was participating in a mentorship program through the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. And I think Dr. Clark could answer.
Could you please identify yourself for the record, please?
Cyril Clark, I serve as Dean of VetMed at Oregon State. Senator, I'm very pleased to update you that we now have a full program, all 4 years of the DVM program, are actually at OSU, and the first class to graduate, having completed all 4 years of that program, was the class of 2007. So we're already on our third year. So we have indeed a full program that covers the array of expertise across small and large animal. The bill before you is important because it really secures that students receiving clinical experience do so in approved educational programs and under the supervision of appropriate people. The Practice Act as it exists specifically exempts students undergoing clinical training as well as veterinarians in the employ of OSU from the licensing requirements. And both of these are very, very important to the continuing work of the DVM program. Specifically, students need to practice the art and the skill of vet med, and they cannot do that unless an exemption is applied. Secondly, with respect to educational programs, not only OSU, but just about everyone in the U.S., we have a tremendous accumulation of expertise there, people from all over the world who represent the very pinnacle of their expertise, but in quite a number of instances, they are internationals and they do not actually have or meet the eligibility requirements for licensure within the state, and that's true for most states. So to continue the program, we need to have these necessary exemptions for students as well as faculty. The initial bill, SB 108, affected the continuing exemption with respect to the veterinarians. Hence, the further amendment in 108-1 is absolutely essential for the continuation of the DVM program. And we are strongly, strongly supportive of that. Should there be any further amendments to the bill, our concern, of course, is whether we still continue those exemptions with respect to licensure. And we, of course, would request that we have adequate opportunity to look over those before they're adopted.
Okay. Other questions? Follow-up?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just follow-up, and maybe the Veterans Association can jump in on this one. How we deal, I mean, obviously we're not all in the valley, so how do we deal with the situation of where we have students that are could be cross-border from the state of Washington, Idaho, Nevada, or California? How will the board deal with that, or how do we make sure that those programs are accredited, or we have the opportunity to get them, for better word, internships, like in Ontario or clear down south
right.
In Malheur County and
right.
South?
Right, and that is more than a possibility. In fact, we would encourage students, for example, from Washington State to seek externship experiences within our state. The existing language in the dash one would allow for that, but it would have to be approved by the board. And so it would have to be done essentially on a case-by-case basis. The college is not opposed, and indeed it recognizes the wisdom of a further amendment to the Dash 1, where in section 13C, uppercase A, Oregon State University could be replaced in that instance by a College of Veterinary Medicine accredited by the AVMA, which of course would meet that particular
right.
need. That amendment, possible amendment, we have taken a look at, and we're very comfortable with that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Because that's my concern: is in rural portions of Oregon that we have people coming down over from Boise, coming down from the north and up from the south, and like doctors, we're short of veterinarians.
It's true.
Any other questions or comments for the panel? And did you want to add something?
If I may.
Yes. Yeah,
thank you, Chair Dan Felder, committee members. My name is Glenn Kolb. I'm executive director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and we do support this bill because we do think it's a necessity, and really like the amendments because what it does, especially the one that Dr. Clark had just suggested, it will allow people from all over the country to come to Oregon. They're already doing that and participating in externships. We don't want to preclude them for that because it's great experience for the students, and we want that ability to be able to continue with the Dash 1 amendment or the other one that possibly could become another amendment that Dr.
Okay.
Clark mentioned would satisfy us.
Okay. If there is another amendment, just to be clear, you need to get it to either my committee staff or to a member of the committee to introduce. And we need that to be quick.
ASAP. And yes. Madam Chair, I'd like to see an amendment that
okay.
recognizes the other.
So maybe, Senator Boquist, you can work with the committee staff to make sure that
be delighted.
Happens.
Someone
and
just
you're
gave
all
the verbiage.
And certainly we want to make sure that you're all in agreement on the amendment, so I'm going to task Senator Boquist to work with you on that. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And there's nobody else signed up for Senate Bill 108. Is there anybody else here that would like to testify on this bill today? Okay, if not, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 108. And we're actually going to open up some work sessions now before we move into our final public hearing. First, I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 448. I need some.
Madam Chair, I move this.
Hold on. I first have to open up a work session on Senate Bill 448. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Actually, Beth, did you want to just comment on the fiscal on that?
Yes. We heard this bill on the 19th, and we did receive a fiscal, and I emailed it to your offices today. The bill directs the Department of Energy to set building practice criteria that meet or exceed the energy efficiency requirements that have already been established in statute. As the selection of criteria and standards are not known at this time, it's difficult to assess the fiscal impacts of this bill. So although there is actual numbers that have been developed, because that there's not the specific standards laid out, it's difficult to assess the cost of the program, but there are several scenarios that were discussed in the fiscal statement.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Any questions? Senator Boquist?
No, just Madam Chair, it does have a fiscal and needs to go to Ways and Means, and I probably will vote no just to make the point that it needs to go to Ways and Means.
It is going.
We'll guarantee it gets there, Madam Chair, because I don't see the referral.
Well,
isn't that the Speaker has their determination to make the final determination?
Well, the motion that was made was that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Right. Madam Chair, if I may.
Yeah.
This morning, I think maybe the assurance that Senator Boquist is looking for is that we, as chairs, we think that this is what's going to be the outcome, and if not, maybe assure your members as to what actions you may take if it goes directly to the floor.
We had talked about this and talked to the Senate President because it initially did not have a referral, but once we got the fiscal back, there was agreement.
$200,000 plus.
Right.
Yeah.
And there is some discussions about that, but that will happen down in probably my committee down in Ways and Means. So, okay. Any other discussion? Okay, with that, clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator Lopez?
Yes.
Aye.
Senator Haft?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Dinkelberg?
Aye. So with that, the motion passes. The bill is sent to the Committee on Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation. Okay, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 448. And we'll now open up a work session on SCR 5. We'll take a motion on that.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 5 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves SCR 5 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Say anything? What's your bill?
I'd love to carry it, Madam Chair.
I was going to assign it to you, so I had a feeling that would happen. Any other discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Yes.
Yes. With that, the motion passes, and Senator Atkinson will carry the bill to the Senate floor. Okay, moving right along here. Next, I will open up, I will close the work session on SCR 5, so make sure I do that, and open up a work session on Senate Bill 189. Oops, and Beth, did you want to say a few comments about that one, please?
Yes. Senate Bill 189 expands the membership of forest classification committees to include one member appointed by the state fire marshal, authorizes the governing body of two or more counties to establish a joint forest land classification committee. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, but no statement was issued. So we just have to...
Okay, so I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 189 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Yes.
Aye. And I will ask Senator Przanski to carry that bill, since I have been assigned multiple bills from his committee, so I am very pleased to have the opportunity to reciprocate.
It's my pleasure, Ann.
Thank you, Senator Przanski. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 189 and open up a work session on our last bill, which is Senate Bill 195. And Beth, if you could refresh our memory on that as well, please.
Senate Bill 195 exempts wave energy projects from minimum standards of development if the project generates less than 5 megawatts of electricity, is within Oregon's territorial sea, and has an application submitted to the Department of State Lands by December 31, 2009. Requires that the project have a license under the Federal Power Act that provides for adaptive management to prevent or mitigate unexpected adverse impacts. This bill sunsets on January 1, 2010, and contains an emergency clause effective on passage. There is no revenue impact on this bill. There is a fiscal statement issued. Basically, it says that the agencies impacted by this bill generally indicate that they expect to have a minimal fiscal impact associated with the passage of this bill, as long as the total number of projects exemptions are 3 or less, which is the number that Water Resource Department has provided an estimate for. There are renewal fees that are the one-time hydroelectric license fees of $6,500 and an annual renewal fee that is $3,700 that pays for the cost of the program.
Okay, great. Thanks, Beth. So, Chair, I'll entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we discussed earlier, I just want to make mention that we're hopeful that the agencies will involve local input in all the decisions they have, even though there's a territoriality issue in regards
with
to whether...
With the territorial sea.
I just want to make sure we're on the record that we address those local issues within the agencies as the best we can.
Senator Boquist, I appreciate you raising that. I've talked with all the agencies involved and certainly reminded them that is part of the agreement with the territorial sea plan, which is consultation with local governments. And I see them all in a row shaking their heads, so that makes me feel very good. So appreciate you bringing that up for the record. Any other comments or questions? Okay, clerk will call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Yes.
Aye. So with that, the motion passes, and I will carry the bill to the Senate floor. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 195. And I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 472. Yes, I'm going to have Beth do an introduction, and then Senator Atkinson is going to testify on the bill.
Senate Bill 472 requires that the State Fish and Wildlife Commission revise the hatchbox program on the Middle and Upper Rogue River beginning January 1st, 2010 and ending on December 31st, 2015. Requires that the commission consult with local communities and conservation groups. Requires that the consultation include hatchbox placement, monitoring, and data collection. Sunsets on January 2nd, 2016.
Great. Thank you, Beth. Welcome, gentlemen. And my vice chair will go ahead and introduce the bill.
Okay, this is the fishing caucus, isn't it?
I was...
There's more to come.
I was going to say they are...
For the record, I'm Senator Jason Atkinson. I represent Southern Oregon. And to my right and to my left are two other senators. I think there will be at least one more coming and probably a House member. And a whole bunch of people that have worked for many, many years to bring this bill to you. What I will do is just say a few comments about the bill, let the members speak. We have a few moment DVD that will show how this works, and then we'll let people testify. Basically what this is a new modern program that incubates fish. It raises fish in a very low mortality rate. It does it in such a way that is genetically pure. It does it in a way that does not work with any of the disease issues that we've seen for so many years. But more important than that, if you can believe it, is the fact that this is a huge win for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has the opportunity, by redoing their commitment to these boxes, the opportunity to have people, conservation groups, school children, as Senator Cruz will tell you, and a whole host of other folks get involved in conservation. What you see is you see people who take ownership of this by the SHEAR Act. I will say that the bill right now is limited to one river system, and we realize that there will be some folks that want to go statewide. We're open to that. And I will also say that after all of the distinguished colleagues testify, it's going to be a very fun time. If you look at the at who the bill is requested by, it's requested by two men with the same name, and they are to my left shoulder, Mr. Halborg and Halborg Jr., two folks who have pushed for years on this. But interestingly, the first time I met Halborg Sr. was on a river. I was told to look for a man who wore pink gloves. And sure enough, on the Kilchuck River, I ran into Halborg Sr. wearing pink dish gloves as he would use them to take care of his guests as a guide. I'll let him explain if you're at all curious. But to say the least, you're talking to the person who pioneered drift boat fishing on the Kenai River. These are people who have committed their whole lives to conservation and to making sure that fish and fishing and outdoor opportunities were passed on to generations. And with that, I will go back to my place and allow all my distinguished colleagues to talk.
Great. Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Senator Cruz, you're to the left, so I'll let you go.
Isn't he always?
I've been waiting years to say that, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be your one opportunity. For the record, Jeff Cruz, State Senator, Senate District 1, which includes about one-third of the Oregon coast, and actually the Umpqua Basin as well, the majority of it. The majority of it, Senator. You have a portion of it.
We'll get the watershed maps out and start doing some digitizing here.
Actually, Senator Przanski and I have a good relationship and the work we do in Douglas County, so it's not an issue. It's all in fun. Senator Atkinson mentioned the advantages and opportunities for school kids. It's been years ago. One of my schools had an outdoor education program. In great scope. They had built pathways and all sorts of things, but the centerpiece of it was their hatchbox program. and it was incredibly successful, and actually they won national awards for their outdoor education program. Unfortunately, that program was shut down, and for reasons that will remain at this point in time a mystery, it seems to a degree that we have had a tendency to say we want more fish but do everything we can to avoid growing more fish in this state. And there's always a lot of reasons behind that. We have dealt with them over the years. But what we have gotten to now is the fact that we can do appropriate wild cross spawning and create fish that, according to National Marine Fisheries Service, they would consider to be wild fish when they come back. And so that's incredibly positive. One of the arguments against these programs is they have a high mortality rate, but their mortality rate is no higher than any other way that fish tend to be propagated. Right now, in our hatchery programs in the state, we are destroying 70% of the eggs because we don't need them, because we have the appropriate number of fish for the hatcheries. But our hatchery system in the state of Oregon is woefully lacking, and we know that, and very expensive. This sort of program, and this would fit well, actually, into the STEP program that we have abandoned over the years, is a golden opportunity for us to get more appropriate fish into our system at no cost. And in my part of the state, the South Coast, that's where STEP was born. And I want to tell you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if my constituents had the opportunity to get reengaged in propagating fish, they would jump at the opportunity. And you know, we have been arguing for years that we need to put more money into hatcheries, upgrade them, and make them state of the art. And quite clearly, we don't have the money to do that. This is an opportunity, Madam Chair, for us to bring some runs back to life, to the point where we can sustain commercial and sport fisheries. And if you travel to the South Coast, those folks are hurting big time. I mean, we're not only kind of in the nexus of the loss of timber payments to sustain county government, but there was virtually no fishing season this last year, and tourism dried up. They are hurting bad, and we need to do some things to revitalize those communities, or they're going to dry up and blow away. And I can't afford to let that happen. So this is a good tool. It's not the absolute solution, but it's a very good tool, and it will reengage the public once again. In doing something that they would love to do, they used to do, and have now been denied. So I wholeheartedly support this. The only issue I have with the bill is it needs to be expanded beyond just the Rogue River. But I would settle for that as a start, but I would like to see this in the Chetco and a few of the other coastal streams as well. So that's my testimony.
Great. Thank you, Senator Cruz. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we'll hold questions to the end. We can grill them all at the end.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, Frank Morse. I represent the Corvallis, Albany area in the State Senate. Well, I'm appearing today in very strong support for this bill and Senator Atkinson. As we look at the state of our anadromous fish runs, to say that we're in crisis, it might be an understatement. And crisis is often the mother of invention. And to create what really is an artificial but yet natural spawning environment and do it in a very cost-effective way is something that we would be well served to give this a shot. I join Senator Cruz and Senator Atkinson. I would love to see this propagated more than just in one river. But this gives us a chance to see if we can make a difference and bring back more fish back into our river systems. So I think you'll find when we testify before your committee next week on additional bills that have to do with fishing, you'll have, I think, a greater appreciation for maybe the passion with which Senator Atkinson and I especially bring to this whole issue. A lifelong, since age five, fisherman. And Senator Atkinson referenced this cultural transfer from generation to generation. And I was exceedingly blessed as a kid growing up. I had a grandpa that wanted to take me fishing, a dad that wanted to take me fishing, and it's just part of my DNA, enjoying rivers and lakes and get a rod in my hand and the ability to catch a fish. There's nothing better. And how do we make that experience real for more and more of our children? It's a character building, it's a lifelong skill building, and it enriches everyone. And if we can bring more fish back into our river systems and have these kinds of experiences in the future, we are very well served. So, Madam Chair, I appear in support of this bill and hope that it will find favor in the committee.
Thank you, Senator Morse. Senator Girod?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Senator Fred Girod. I represent Senate District 9, which is rural Clackamas, Marion, and Linn County. Partly more specifically for this bill, I have almost all of the North and South Saniam watersheds, the Upper Clackamas and the Mallala. I, too, am in strong support of Senate Bill 472 to kind of reiterate some things that have been brought up by other testimonies. We have excess fish eggs, fertilized fish eggs, and we have people that want to help. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that fish, and they are very passionate people. And like Senator Morris said, it's kind of in your DNA. I, too, everybody's talking about age five. I caught my first steelhead when I was 5 years old and probably my first salmon when I was seven. So it's something I've done my whole life, and it's almost a rite of passage for kids to go out and catch fish. And so those people that feel very passionate about that would be volunteers to help with hatch boxes. And the nice thing about it is it adds to the wild fish count. Now, for you that don't think that that's an economic problem, and I don't think there's probably anybody on this committee that feels that way, but you have to look at the collapse that happened on the Sacramento and the Klamath and the high cost of what that cost, dam removal, silt removal, whatever that's going to cost is going to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, I'm on a river that has the potential of winter steelhead and salmon becoming endangered, and so that's going to be a horrific cost, and one that my valley probably isn't going to be willing to pay. So with hatch boxes, we can get the numbers up for possible ESA-listed fish and help with any prevention of dam removal. And once again, there are just hundreds and hundreds of people that would volunteer to do this at probably little or no cost to the agency. So if we're looking at solutions, please don't look at solutions of what we've done in the past, because it apparently has not worked. So we have to go outside the box a little bit, or inside the hatch box, probably the better way of putting it, and come up with a different solution. I think this is a great way to start, and I, too, would urge that it not just be for the rogue. And please, with all my heart, Senate Bill 42 is a really, really good bill.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming here today. Are there any questions for our colleagues? Appreciate your coming in support of the bill.
Thank you.
And next, I'm going to call up Halbert Senior and Junior. Halbert Senior and Junior. And
would you like to play the movie first? Make all this
sure. Sense. Why don't we get that going then? We have a video.
You just sit here and I'll play that for you.
Looks like they brought more buckets.
Yeah.
This could be revenue neutral. We're going to have boxes the whole river, right?
Thank you.
is a critical time for the salmon population. Natural spawning has declined dramatically over the past 50 years. The need to enhance our salmon stocks is well documented. The necessity for increased salmon enhancement programs by public volunteers has never been greater. The Jordan Scotty Salmonid Egg Incubator is just one tool that can help to restore many of our neglected fish-rearing areas. A low egg survival rate of between 5 and 20% in natural spawning is the result of several factors. Not all eggs are fertilized when deposited. Not all eggs are successfully buried. Fungus from dead eggs will spread to healthy eggs. Some eggs are eaten by predators. Some eggs are covered with silt and suffocate. And some eggs will dry up when the water level drops. The Jordan Scotty Incubator, sometimes referred to as the Salmon Condominium, is a scientifically designed and tested plastic incubation box. The original prototype was researched and constructed in the 80s by Mr. Fred Jordan, a former salmonid technician with many years' experience in stream enhancement. Scott Plastics Limited carried out the technical side of the Jordan Scotty development from 1992 to 1996 to economically bring about the most practical production methods for its large-scale use. The incubator was developed to provide an efficient aid in the stream incubating of salmon or trout eggs. The unique design either eliminates or minimizes most of the problems experienced by natural spawning. The Jordan Scotty Salmon Condominium has proven very successful in egg-to-fry hatch results. Pilot testing indicates that with use of the incubator, survival rates from egg to fry are often better than 90%. A number of salmonid species have shown good results from use of the Jordan Scotty incubator, including chinook, coho, sockeye, pinks, chum, steelhead, rainbow trout, and eastern trout. These are just a few of the species that can benefit. As a result of using the incubator, all eggs are fertilized and very few are lost. Disease and fungal infection spreading from egg to egg is stopped, since each egg has its own separate chamber to mature in. The eggs are effectively quarantined from each other during this period. Eggs are also protected from predators and silt suffocation. Only at the end of the incubation period, when the hatched elephant has absorbed most or all of its yolk sac, will the now developed fry be able to leave its chamber and bury itself in the surrounding gravel. There it will remain for a short period of time until ready to emerge as a larger and stronger fish. The Jordan Scotty Salmon Incubator is designed to hold 200 single eggs per plate set. For example, these five units hold 1,000 eggs. Plates are color-coded to accommodate varying sizes of salmon and trout species. Consult your local hatchery or Scott Plastics Limited, Scotty Marine Products Division, for specific information on egg sizes and recommended plates. The Jordan Scotty Salmon Condominium is simple to use. A variety of different trays are suitable for the loading procedure. Placing the side plate into the tray, float the eggs over the plate until each cell is filled. Although one egg per cell is recommended, when using very small eggs, more than one is acceptable. While loading the eggs, keep the units level at all times. Once the first plate has been loaded, a second side plate is placed on top. Plates can be secured together temporarily using strong clips. Once all the plates have been added, the clips should be removed. The unit should then be secured by nylon bolts. When When set in the stream, plates must be positioned upright as demonstrated here, horizontal with hole tabs at the top. Escape holes must be at the bottom of each cell, otherwise sand and silt will eventually build up and block the unit. When choosing a location for the Jordan Scotty incubator, pick concealed spots that will be protected from vandalism or curiosity. It is very important that the units of fertilized eggs be placed in the stream gravel so that they are continually covered by an adequate flow of water passing through the gravel and the cells. Again, make sure that the units are located so that the escape holes of the egg compartments are at the bottom of each cell. This is essential to assure that sand particles wash right through the compartment. Incubators should be strongly secured to ensure that they remain in position. Place them in a stream location that is not in danger of flash flooding. For example, downstream from a large boulder that is not likely to move, or securely attached to rebar which is firmly embedded in stream gravel. During the incubation period, the incubators should be checked regularly to ensure that they remain in position, are not covered with debris, and have a continuous flow of water. Do not disturb or open the units until all the fry have passed through the escape holes. Consult a local hatchery.
I want to make sure everybody gets a chance to testify, so we're going to just move on from there, but I think folks get a sense of what the hatchbox do and how for those who've never seen a hatchbox, now you know how a hatchbox works. So thank you, and for the record, can you please state your name? And
Madam Chair, my name is Hal Borg, Jr., and I want to thank you and your committee members for lending us this time. And I'm a 20-year river guide, retired, and now presently a dentist in Medford, Oregon. And would you like us to hand this out now?
Yeah, we'll get the committee staff to do that.
Okay.
Yeah. If you can just hand it to her, then she can hand it out.
Okay. What we have is an outline of a plan of implementation. We would like to reiterate that these are incubation boxes. They very efficiently hatch healthy wild stock back into the river, untouched by human hands. And we have several goals with this, and one is to coordinate with the Fish and Wildlife Department and local schools and community members, and all work together to enhance fisheries. And we'd like to start right in our backyard on the Rogue River, because that's where I was raised, and we certainly know that river very, very well. And in the outline here, we'll just kind of go through this quickly, but our objectives, you know, are basically to increase the migratory fish returns. And our goal is not just to bring it back to management levels or ideal levels, but to bring the fishery back to uncommonly high levels. And that's just not a term that's used very often when you talk about managing fisheries, especially migratory fisheries. We usually seem to want to get to sustainable levels, and what we would like to see is uncommonly high returns. And we'd like a lot of fish bubbling back in this river. This section of the Rogue River is commonly known as the Upper Rogue. It is above a dam and near the Coal River hatcheries. It's a section of river probably about 25 miles long. And what we need to make this go is healthy fertilized eggs. And this can't go anywhere until we know that we have eggs. And so once we get those eggs, we've determined that 1 million fertilized eggs or 1,000 incubation boxes fully loaded in this section of river will give us a very good sample and should produce excellent returns that will be easily identifiable during the regular spawning and returning cycle. We've identified five sites, or runs as we're calling them. These are areas that are commonly known as normal and healthy spring Chinook spawning grounds. And we want to put these boxes in areas that these fish normally thrive in. They're not thriving there right now, and we're in a spiraling pattern right now of returns. But we want to put these hatch boxes or incubator boxes back into these areas that have traditionally been known as healthy spawning areas. This is a proactive enhancement project. We want to bring back wild fish, and sometimes that's hard to understand because we have traditionally thought of man's involvement as more like hatchery or man's help, but these truly would be wild fish that would be harvested and then their eggs and then fertilized and returned untouched by human hands and then hatch and swim out of these incubating boxes and are never touched by human hands again until they're possibly sport caught. So we wanted to emphasize that. Dad, do you have anything?
I have a quick question. Are these being used currently in rivers in the Northwest or West Coast somewhere?
Could I defer to my father on that?
Sure.
Yes.
And for the record, can you state your name?
Yeah, Hal Borg, Sr. And they're used not only in Oregon, they've been used worldwide. New Zealand, Europe, quite a few other places I can't recall right now, but they've been used and tested and very successfully.
And are there specific, just to follow up, specific rivers in the Northwest where they're being utilized right now?
Cedar Creek and on the Isle Sea system,
mm-hmm.
There is that's one I know of.
Nestucca.
And then Nestucca.
Yeah, Nestucca. Okay. Nestucca, yeah.
And great. And would you like to add anything to the testimony?
Well, the loading of these boxes, this is a new item the company's come out with. It's called a loading tray. And it holds the 200 eggs to fill these. And you use a natural wild feather out of a goose or a turkey or something. No, nobody touches the eggs. The eggs are feathered onto this tray, which is great for the school kids. The kids can get in here. They can use the feather. They can fill this tray up. And the matching half plate just goes on there. It's flipped over. And you got your 200 eggs all loaded, ready to go. Put your other half together and... Every kid from the first grade on, kindergarten, can participate and be successful in this restoration project. And hopefully in 3 years to 4 years, we can take as many as we can out there and catch a fish with them, 20 pounds or better.
It would be really nice if we could grow money like that for our budget. So are there any questions for this panel?
Can I lead the witnesses just a little bit before
sure.
They drive home and say, oh, I forgot to say this. Ms. Rohr, could you talk to us a little bit about disease? I think the committee's fairly well attuned to things like whirling disease and the New Zealand mud snail and the other diseases that happen and some of the problems that happen from hatcheries where things are top-fed. Could you explain why this works so well and is disease-free?
Yeah, the unit, when it's filled up and sealed with the stainless steel nuts, becomes its own prison, you might say, for the eggs. Nothing, the eggs can't get out, and nothing can get in at the eggs. That's why we have the 90-95% hatch rate of 1,000 eggs. We're really getting a good hatch rate because of these diseases can't get at the eggs.
Could you say what kind of success happened in the 1980s?
In the 1980s?
Yeah.
On the hatch boxes?
Yes, sir.
Yes, we didn't have these particular incubators, and we had to use open box hatch boxes that were stream side, sat along the river. Water came in above, ran out the other end, and they had to be tended every day. Fungus eggs picked out, diseased eggs picked out, and this box eliminates all those type problems that we had had before, where this basically does not have to be tended at all. It's its own unit. Can go by and look at it and make sure a log isn't floated on top of it, but nobody needs to open it. It stays sealed until the swim-up fry are out and on their own. They're right out there alongside the wild fish babies. They all go out through all the perils. The crawdads are after them. The frogs are after them, and only the strong survive and the healthy, and that's the ones we want to come back as adults and spawn. So we're really producing wild, strong, healthy adult Chinook salmon to come back to our fisheries, or steelhead or coho.
Let me ask one more quick question. Mr. Borg, opponents are going to come up and say that this isn't scientific and that this doesn't work and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I realize that the statute that we're looking at here addresses the statute that was based in the 1980s. And we have a different technology now that's certainly not open old refrigerators or septic tanks cut in half, uses hatch boxes. But could you speak just a little bit to why this will work now and why the science is better now than it was 20 years ago? And even with limited science, how much success was had in the Rogue?
I think that if we would have brought a picture of the old hatch box, it would have spoke more than 1,000 words. Basically, you were talking about a plywood about the size of a refrigerator, lined with PVC and gravel. I started guiding in the early 80s at the ripe age of 16, and I was a second-generation river guide, so I leaned on him for all of my early knowledge. But when I started guiding, the Chetco is the one that I have the most experience with at that time, even though the Rogue was being utilized in that program as well. In my first years of guiding on that river, it was almost devoid of catchable salmon and steelhead. Almost my entire first year of guiding, I caught very few fish. And in just a matter of 4 years in that program, my last couple of years of guiding before I went off to dental school, we limited almost every day. And just in a few years, we saw a very dramatic increase in sport catchable fish. I don't have statistics on exact numbers that returned during that era. As a matter of fact, even on the Rogue, it was a loosely organized program at that time. However, we are meeting regularly with members that were involved in that hatchbox program on the Middle Rogue in the Grants Pass Steelheaders Association. These are old-timers that basically were involved and had these in their backyards and in the rivers, and their testimony and what they saw swimming and jumping in the holes behind their house, big schools of fish that had never been there before, really speaks volumes of what this can do. The now that's with plywood boxes lined with Fisqueen. This technology provides for probably 4 to 5 times higher survival rate of hatching eggs. So the number of swim-up fry goes from 20 to 25% success to 90 to 95%. So it's pretty easy to extrapolate and do the math and see what the potential gain is for returning fish.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Senator Przanski.
Mr. Borg Sr., you mentioned something about the way this program would work with the hatch boxes when the fish are coming out, that they would, only the strongest would be surviving. You made the comment that they would be as if native. So is the difference here, I mean, the eggs are going to be coming from the hatchery or through the state, I would assume, wherever they come from. But the theory is that since they're not in a contained hatchery as compared to being in the wild, in the river, that they will have the same attributes except for being incubated eggs or that's been harvested from a hatchery fish?
Yeah, this is true. Takes a wild, the male salmon and wild female salmon put their eggs in here. Those babies come out, they are exactly the same as a wild nest right next door to it. They're doing all the same thing, going through all the perils of the wild fish. They're out of human hands. I could say that would be the best way. Human hands aren't involved as far as these fish slides go, except in the egg form when we get them from the hatchery mm-hmm. and put them in the boxes. But they're still untouched by human hands. So
right.
It's as close to a native wild egg as you could get without actually having the two salmon in your hand, which also can be done. You can have the two salmon wild in the stream and milk them into a bucket and put those eggs in here. That will also work. You can do that also.
Okay.
But we're hoping to utilize as many of our hatchery facilities we can. That gives us a broader egg base to use. And as things go along, we hope to increase and help more and more rivers recuperating, you know. We have the fish are kind of like trees. You plant the baby trees, they grow. You put the baby fish in there, and they'll come back as big ones. Not all of them, but the ones that come back will be the faster, smarter, stronger ones. The others are going to get eaten or go through the perils of the ocean, but they'll be good ones, the ones that all come back. That's why we need a fairly large number of eggs. We need a large amount of fry to go out. And a million fry, we could get a run back of 30 to 45,000 adult fish. That would be over and above what the hatchery could put out on a river. We would also have their fish and other wild fish. So a river that's got 10 or 15,000 fish could potentially in 4 years be a river of 80,000, maybe 70, 80,000 fish in a short period of 3 to 4 years.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for coming here today. And I think we're going to hear first from some other folks here on this bill.
Okay.
So I appreciate
Thank
you.
Thank you. For Senator Atkinson, when you're at the grocery store and they're out of brown gloves, you wind up with pink gloves.
Thank you.
Hey, I am going to ask the Department of Fish and Wildlife to come up now, and that's Kurt Melcher, and I know you have somebody else with you, Kurt. Great. And Kurt, in addition to your testimony, I'm hoping you can provide a little bit of history in the Hatchbox program for my colleagues. I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I think it would be good to just talk a little bit about the history of the Hatchbox program from the state of Oregon.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Atkinson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I brought with me today Russ Stoff. He's the Rogue River Watershed Manager and actually currently the Acting Southwest Regional Manager in our Southwest region. I want to thank you for having us here today to talk with you about Senate Bill 472. Senate Bill 472 would direct the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to revise hatchbox programs on the middle and upper Rogue River after consultation with local communities and conservation groups. As noted in Senate Bill 472, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission currently has statutory authority for hatchbox programs. We actually have programs up and down the coast that are still in effect today. Elements of the statutes relative to the hatchbox program were revised in 1999 to bring the hatchbox programs into compliance with the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, and also to, I think, from a lot of folks' perspective, to rein in a program that was very large and was many times referred to as kind of the Johnny Appleseed approach to fish management, where we were putting hatchery origin fish in many different systems up and down the coast and in inland areas. The primary factor that determines the effectiveness of hatch boxes, and when I say effectiveness, I mean effectiveness in terms of adult returns from those programs. The primary factors that contribute to the effectiveness is spawning gravel and fry production levels. So, for instance, in systems that are where a primary limiting factor is spawning gravel or the fry life stage in the life history of these fish, hatch boxes can and do make a difference in terms of adult returns. In populations where the bottleneck is at some other life stage, whether that be at the fingerling or smolt life stage or ocean entry, estuary rearing capacity, whatever the case may be, in those situations, then additional fry production is generally considered to be unnecessary. You've got a bottleneck somewhere else in the population that's limiting total production. We've done on the Rogue, we're very fortunate on the Rogue River in that we have 30 years of very extensive research that was funded by the federal government in response and in relation to the construction of Lost Creek and Applegate dams. This work, as I mentioned, generally has shown us that spawning gravel and fry life history in the middle and upper Rogue is not a primary limiting factor for these populations. Nonetheless, we are fortunate in that we have this information. It's good information. It's strong. The breadth of the information and the strength of the information has allowed us to move forward in developing conservation plans in the Rogue River for first spring Chinook, which the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission recently adopted the spring Chinook management plan. We have embarked on a fall Chinook management plan for the Southwest Oregon ESU, which includes the Rogue population. And in all of these discussions and through these processes, hatch boxes and all propagation programs are some of the tools and are part of the discussion as we develop these plans. With regard to specific history of hatch box programs, I mentioned it a little bit. You know, the programs really developed and flourished in the 1980s and into the early 1990s. Generally, since that time, we've scaled back. We do, though, as I mentioned, have hatch box programs, and I will just refer to a table here that you all do not have, but I can certainly provide. Mm-hmm. In 2008, for instance, we had hatch box programs that had a direct stream release of about 730,000 fry. So,
which basin was this?
A number of basins. It's roughly in about I'm going to say about 15 basins up and down the coast. The 700,000 was spread out through all those. So they're small programs, 50,000 here, 75,000. So there are currently hatchbox incubator programs in place. Additionally, we have hatchbox and incubator programs in place where the fish are not direct released, but in fact are then, after they swim up as fry, they're then transferred to a step facility, a salmon trout enhancement program facility, where they're then reared to full term as smolts. And we see certainly with smolts and smolt releases very relatively high survival rates compared to direct stream releases. I also wanted to mention to the commission or to the committee that we have our Hatchery Research Center here in Western Oregon. Our director of that research center, Dr. Noakes, has recently submitted a proposal to Sea Grant to do some additional
to numbers.
Evaluation of hatchbox programs and hatchbox efficacy with Chinook salmon.
Maybe we should hear from the Rogue Watershed persons. That would be great as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Russ Stoff. I'm the Rogue Watershed Manager, currently acting as the Regional Supervisor for Southwest Region, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I had not seen a proposal from the Borgs on this yet, so I wasn't clear on what species they might be interested in. Spring Chinook is a very difficult issue on the Rogue River, of course. And first, I'd like to express my appreciation for the sincerity and the commitment that members of the community like the Borgs bring forward on this issue. I think in the past, on some of our hatchbox programs, conflict has developed, and we've not expressed an appreciation for the commitment and sincerity of the public on this issue. So I do value their sincerity and believe that they mean the best. Spring Chinook, if we'd like to speak specifically about Spring Chinook on the Rogue, since that was the proposal, Spring Chinook historically occupied the main stem Rogue from upstream of Gold Ray Dam or near Shady Cove, upstream beyond where the current Lost Creek Dam is. They historically spawned in the main stem, with the exception of a small percentage of the population spawning in lower Big Butte Creek. The construction of Lost Creek Dam in the late 1970s cut off about 25% of their spawning habitat that accounted for about a third of the production. So it was only a quarter of the spawning habitat, but it was very productive and produced about a third of the overall smolt for that population. To mitigate for the loss of that spawning habitat, the federal government pays Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to operate Coal Rivers Hatchery, where we produce annually and release 1,620,000 spring Chinook smolts that go into the Rogue River to compensate for that loss upstream of the dam. That smolt program is also intended to compensate for impacts due to water quality downstream of the dam. And when the dam was built, along with Applegate dams, it was intended to benefit Chinook salmon. And the intent was that Lost Creek Dam would benefit Spring Chinook, and that the Applegate Dam on the Applegate River and the Rogue Basin would benefit Fall Chinook. The Applegate Dam came in as predicted. It's been very beneficial to Fall Chinook, and we've seen Fall Chinook numbers increase dramatically in the Rogue Basin. However, the Lost Creek Dam did not end up benefiting wild spring Chinook salmon in the Rogue, and that's primarily due to water temperatures, although there are other dam operation issues. When the dam was built, there's a tower behind the dam that controls at what level you can withdraw water for the outflow. And in the summertime, late spring through early fall, the reservoir is stratified with cool water on the bottom and warm water on the top. And so you can very effectively draw cool water off if you need and use that to benefit fish. I should add at this point that those dams were the first, and I believe the only ones in the nation built with fish management as a primary authorized use. So there's water allocated at each dam for fish management, and hence the extensive research that went into the 30 years on the Rogue. The problem is that Spring Chinook, in the Rogue spawn now downstream of the dam in the main stem late September through the first half of October. Those fish are then subject to water coming out of the dam to incubate them over the wintertime. That water is cool only until the reservoir mixes in mid-November, and then it turns over. Water temperatures run 4 or 5 degrees warmer than they were historically, and those eggs are then subject to warmer water temperatures, causing the fry to emerge early. Those early emerging fry are subject to fairly high mortality. So the issue there is not so much production of fry, rather it's the survival of the fry. A primary purpose of the Rogue Spring Chinook Conservation Plan that we recently developed in combination with a 14-member public advisory committee, one of which the members here today, was to develop some strategies to work with the Army Corps of Engineers to reduce that mortality on wild spring Chinook fry and bring them back to the desired status established in the plan of 15,000. That plan was adopted in September of 2007 by our commission.
All right, I think we're going to take questions because we do have a couple more folks signed up that would like to testify. So questions for the department? Senator?
Several quick questions. Number one, the bill does not list, is not species specific.
Absolutely.
And that's by design. Number two, you mentioned 700,000, and I'm holding the Coal Rivers Hatchery operation plan from last year. At a million smolt release, what's been your success rate?
We Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, we measure that success rate on the smolt to adult return survival rate. It's completely variable on ocean conditions, and when there's good ocean conditions, it can approach 5%. So in 1996, we saw over 80,000 adult spring Chinook return over Gold Ray Dam. Recent years, the survival rates due to ocean conditions has been very low.
And you attribute all that to ocean conditions?
Yes, we do.
Okay. I think we can talk about quite a few other things, and I know there's other people that want to talk, but I really don't know why the agency wouldn't want a victory on the Rogue River. I have not met a happy guide, and I know there's a whole generation of kids that do not fish on the Rogue River anymore because there's no fish. I don't know why we wouldn't want to help this fishery. That's just
I don't understand that.
Well, we'll hear from some other folks in the basin, I think, and I'm sure we'll have some more discussions with the department. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
So we've got just about every fishing group in Oregon that's here to testify. First, we have Raymond Miller with the Mid-Willamette Valley Anglers, Norm Ritchie, Association Northwest Steelheaders, and Dave, is it Ballard, with the CCA? Welcome, gentlemen. Whoever gets there first gets to start, so you win. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and Committee, for the record, my name is Raymond Miller. I'm presently the president of the Mid-Willamette Valley Angling Club. I'm also a member of CCA and support Oregon Anglers. These groups are doing their best to help alleviate a situation that's just been, in my lifetime, going down, down, down. And I think this bill is not an answer incomplete, but it's a step in the right direction. Give you a little history. Members of our club are actively involved in the Rhodes Pond project over on the Nestucca River, where we raise, clip, and release about 100,000 smolt a year. That is, if we can get enough fish to get enough eggs. Last year, it was touch and go. Also, members of our club support and are actively involved in kids groups where we have kid fishing days. We're doing our best to keep the younger generation involved in fishing. When all of us old fellas go, who's going to be fishing? Yeah, you take most of these young folks fishing nowadays, you might have to take them 5 or 6 days before they catch a fish. This is not going to get them interested in fishing. They're going to go right back to the television sets. And this isn't what we need. I know the majority of the Department of Fish and Wildlife is funded by license fees, and if we have a whole generation coming down the road here that doesn't fish, we're not only looking at not many fish, but we're looking at a department that isn't going to be able to function. talking about hatchbox programs, no one's mentioned it, but Gary Loomis, a few years ago in Washington, was given permission by the Department of Fish and Wildlife in Washington to try a hatchbox program for coho salmon on a river that was virtually dead. It had no fish. At one time, it supported a big run. This was all done by volunteers, and within a few years, after learning some hard lessons on the program, they had a return of over 100,000 fish in that river. The Department of Fish and Wildlife, I know Kurt mentioned the other day at a meeting that you run into a problem with adding more fry in a river because they don't have food. Well, we have a way of giving them food. And that was demonstrated in Gary Loomis's program when they just took carcasses from the hatchery and put them in the river. And this is their natural food. And once they started doing that, their returns just grew. And, of course, as the return grows, you have carcasses from the return to feed the fry. So saying a river can't support more fish really is not a good argument. And Chair Dingfelder, you asked about, I think it was Mr. Borg, about the difference between the fish being wild and hatchery. A lot of it is the feeding process. In a hatchery, as I know from being involved with the Rhodes Pond, you throw a bunch of pellets on the water and they all come up and eat the pellets. When you have a hatchbox program, these fish learn to survive in the wild by eating naturally. When you release a bunch of fish that are looking for their food to hit the water in the form of a pellet, I think the survival rate right off the bat is handicapped. And again, I want to stress the importance of this program is not only to increase our fish, but it to involve the young generation in a volunteer program that gets them interested in fishing and keep the sport alive. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mark.
Chair Dingfelder, thank you for this opportunity. I'd like to thank Senator Atkinson for preparing this bill on behalf of a couple of our members and for all of the steelheaders throughout the state where this type of activity could take place. I have provided written testimony, so I'll just go over the highlights. Basically, the department has a native fish conservation policy and a resulting hatchery management policy. And I think that with those in place, that the discussions and choices of where to put hatch boxes can be done in a way that they will stay effective.
Norm, can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Norm Ritchie, Government Affairs Director for the Association of Northwest Steelheaders.
Thank you.
And I might mention my appreciation for Senator Cruz's statements, as I'm also a member of the STAC, the Salmon Trout Advisory Committee, over STEP, and the need for funding for the kids' programs, the Egg to Fry program, and kids getting out into the streams and getting an appreciation for the habitat.
So I have a question for you about that, about since you're on the STEP Advisory Committee. So are hatch boxes being utilized as part of the STEP program anywhere in the state currently?
Yes. The Miami in the Tillamook system mm-hmm. Has some hatch boxes. And that's the only one that I've been directly involved in. I'm not sure where else there might
I'll ask the department to follow up with that information because I'm sure they have it as well. Okay.
Okay.
Great. Did you want to add anything? We have your written testimony.
Yes. I mentioned that with the policies in place and utilizing egg incubation and hatch boxes in conjunction with those policies, there should be opportunities throughout the state. Let's see. Senator Grodd mentioned the Santa Yam. That's a basin with dams up the high end, which not only block fish passage to the historic spawning, but also block gravel migration downstream. And the areas directly below the dams start becoming less susceptible to spawning. And therefore, you still have a lower basin quite capable of providing for the growth of fish to the smolt stage without that many fish in the stream. So this sort of thing could be looked at in those type of applications, as well as reintroducing fish in areas where fish passage had been eliminated and then restored.
Great. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Dale Ballard. I live in Malala, and
sorry, I called you Dave.
Yeah, that's okay. I didn't write it down; that somebody else did. So, anyway, I'm pleased to be here today on behalf of the Coastal Conservation Association, Oregon, representing nearly 4,000 members and 11 chapters, including the Rogue Valley chapter with nearly 100 members. CCA would like to express our support for Senate Bill 472. Regarding hatch boxes, which has been introduced by Senator Jason Atkinson. Hatchery programs often play an important role in conserving salmon and steelhead populations while also providing fishing opportunities for the citizens of the Pacific Northwest. That's fishing opportunities for both sport and commercial, equating to improving jobs and revenue. CCA Oregon supports efforts to ensure hatchery programs are being managed consistently with best available science and ongoing salmon recovery efforts. CCA Oregon also believes the program represents an opportunity to bring local residents, anglers, and conservationists together to benefit local salmon populations on the Rogue River. CCA Oregon also supports the proposed hatchbox legislation for salmon supplementation on the Rogue River based on our understanding of the proponent's commitment to using native brood stock, ongoing monitoring and evaluation, and the importance of nutrients to boosting the efficiency of the program. And as a personal note, I'm native Oregonian, was raised on the Sandy River, fished it from at the time I was probably 4 or 5 years old. And like you've heard everybody say, our fishing opportunities, the runs are dwindling. I think this is a good idea. I would like to see eventually this program expanded. We have the Sandy Am, the little North Sandy Am is still free flowing. I understand where dams are concerned, you have issues with water temperature and where they turn over in the reservoirs and that kind of thing. So where science bases, and it's appropriate, I think we need to take a look on down the road and maybe expanding this a little bit more. As a child growing up, I didn't have a computer, didn't watch a lot of TV. You found me down on the river. And I think this is just a great opportunity to get kids involved and get them away from the TV set, and maybe mom and dad getting them out into the outdoors and doing something besides sitting there playing video games. So I would just like to see this really enthusiastically endorsed. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming here today. Wait, before you get up, we'll see if there's any questions from the dais for you. No. Thank you very much for making the trip here today and providing us with your input. And the last panel will cover the rest of the fishing groups in the state. Let's see, we've got Joe Rolander with the Oregon Guides Packers, Oregon Anglers. David Moskowitz signed up. I don't know if David's back there, Native Fish Society. And then we have Steve Byerlin with the Oregon Guides and Packers. I guess we've got two of y'all. Joe, why don't you go ahead and start?
Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rolader. I live on the Alsea River, just a little ways above the town of Walport, Oregon. I represent the Oregon Guides and Packers, the Mackenzie River Guides Association, and the Curry Guides Association. And I'm here today to present written testimony on behalf of the Oregon Anglers. Dennis Ritchie, who is the executive director of the Oregon Anglers, is the chairman of the advisory group at the Oregon Research Hatchery Center. And I opposed that hatchery to start with, so I decided once the hatchery was up and running, I'd go to all the meetings. So I've been to these meetings, and I've seen quite a little bit of research that's been done at the hatchery that I think is pertinent to what we're talking about today. Dennis talks about a study, and your its printed handout gives you a better idea what that study is. It compares unfed fry to one-year-old smolts to naturally spawned fish in their productivity in the second and third generation. And according to this research, which is preliminary and has not yet been published nor peer-reviewed, the particular basin they're working in the Umpqua, they found that unfed fry that were released into the gravel and naturally spawning fry of the same age had about the same productivity in the second generation. They also found that it didn't make a lot of difference if the parents of those fish were, in this report it says CC, clipped, which means they were of hatchery origin parents versus wild, which is non-hatchery origin parents. So it's interesting research. Mr. Ritchie also talks about the Lewis River study that was alluded to earlier, that where Gary Loomis used hatch boxes to bring back the Lewis River. And the key to that seemed to be the supplementation with adults, carcasses. When I was a long time ago, back in the 60s, I was involved in the STEP program and the hatchbox program on the Alsea. And, I'm not a fishery scientist, so I don't know all of this, but I know that we worked with a box that didn't even have any gravel in it. It was just a wooden box, and we put eggs in it. As somebody said, we picked the dead eggs out all the time. When the fry were ready to leave, they left. But We kept this program going for about 10 years, and finally the ODFW said we couldn't have any eggs anymore because those unfed fry weren't producing any adult returns. Now, we were working on cricks that had been damaged severely by debris flows in the 60s, 64 flood specifically, and they had actually no habitat in those cricks at all for any fish to spawn in, and yet the mouths of where those cricks came down into the LC was where we all caught steelhead when we took our clients later. So I think there was probably some return. I don't know how long that return was self-sustaining, but I believe we had some fish returning. Now, these hatch boxes that we talked about today, this in-stream incubation system that Scotty has developed, looks to me like it's a jump forward in the science. At the Hatchery Research Center, we heard some research that said that fry that are grown in gravel versus fries that are just grown in a open hatchery box have bigger brains. So if the little fish grew up in the gravel, it has a bigger brain than a little fish that didn't grow up in the gravel. Now that kind of makes sense to me because they have to make decisions, they have to survive, and so that little piece of the puzzle looks to me like the hatchery box that Senator Atkinson is talking about is really a jump forward. We also know a lot more about the husbandry of the fish that we're going to use for eggs. The eggs that we were using on the LC were eggs of a hatchery run that had been coho hatchery run, which was later discontinued because the return to the hatchery was so low. It was actually 10% of the coastwide average was the return to the LC hatchery. So we were using eggs. We're using technology that isn't nearly as good as we have now. So I think this is a great program. I think it should be used statewide, and I ask for your support. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Joe.
Chair Dingfelder, committee. My name is Steve Byerlin. I'm from Gold Beach, Oregon. I've been a guide on the Rogue River for 26 years. I've been involved working on fish and wildlife projects since 1970. And the hatch box program, while I have never worked, you know, doing the hatch box itself, done a lot of in-stream projects. The listening to Russ Stoff talk about the, let me go back just a second. I also was on the Rogue Spring Salmon Conservation Committee for 3 years until its completion. I'm on the committee for South Coast Fall Chinook for also, and we just started that. It's been about, we've had two or three meetings. I started fishing the Rogue River in 1967. There's never been a shortage of food in the Rogue River that I know of. I've never seen a skinny fry. I've never seen a skinny smolt. You know, there's tons of mayflies, caddisflies, all kinds of bug activity in the Rogue River. I don't know how it could possibly be short on food for any number of fish that might be put in there. Predation on each other, possibly, but not short on food for, you know, fry to eat. We have a emergency on the Rogue River in Spring Chinook. Spring Chinook have been impacted drastically by Lost Creek Dam, which, as Russ said, the water would be too warm in the wintertime, causing the fry to or the eggs to hatch too soon. And basically, the upper Rogue is lethal to spring Chinook salmon. I don't believe that they'll ever recover in the mainstream Rogue River as natural spawners, and I don't think the hatchery system has done anything over the last 1977 when they started it, you know, and I didn't make copies of this, but I have one that maybe you could make copies to give the committee. But this is the spring salmon runs on the Rogue River and what's happened to them over time. We had 35,000 fish average prior to the dam. After the dam, we went to 23,000 fish. The last probably 8 of the last 10 years, we've been under 5,000 or 6,000 wild spring chinook. And at this time, I doubt that when we were talking about wild spring chinook, they come through a band. But the early fish component is the most important. Those are the ones that came in first and would spawn the earliest. those fish have virtually disappeared other than in basically one tributary. I doubt that there's less than, there's more than 1,500 of these early wild spring chinook left. If we don't do something like the hatch box system and put those hatch boxes into the tributaries that are not affected by Lost Creek Dam, that early component will disappear. Right now they're calling the spring chinook on the rogue sprawls because they're interbreeding with the fall fish. And so the spring chinook is disappearing because it's spawning later, and the spring chinook are spawning spawning later, and the fall chinook are coming up and spawning earlier, so they're mixing. And the virtually, in my opinion, after decades of working on this stream, the only way these fish will be saved is by doing something similar to the incubation box in tributaries. And it would make an immediate turnaround, I'm sure,
Okay, thank you. David?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is David Moskowitz. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the Native Fish Society. The Native Fish Society is a wild fish conservation organization in Oregon. The president of our organization actually also served on the Spring Chinook Advisory Committee. Along with Steve and many other people, in fact, almost all the stakeholders. And it was a very extensive process, sometimes very contentious. All measures were kind of on the table for that process. And at that time, hatch boxes were not part of the, were not one of those measures being considered. And that is because, as the department has already testified, they're not limiting, the river's not limiting for spawning grounds or fry production. So it doesn't meet the criteria for the scientific use of a hatch box. But this committee just met for 3 years talking about this very same species, the spring chinook, and the hatch box was not part of those measures that was considered, and many measures were brought to the table before some were agreed upon. That's one reason that we don't support this bill, because the extensive process just went on for this species. The weight of credible scientific evidence doesn't bear up the use or projected returns that people speak about today using this technology, whether it's the old technology that we used through the 80s and 90s or whether this new technology has any promise. There's not a track record of success for this in this state. The monitoring wasn't there. These are tiny fish that you allow to go out, and they're not able to be marked. There's no way to tell if these are the fish that are returning, the fish that were referred to by some of the earlier speakers that were porpoising and jumping in the pools. The runs on the Rogue River have varied over the years, and that is a lot due to ocean conditions. It's also due to freshwater conditions. But just to talk about the fish on the Rogue, and I know that Senator Atkinson is an avid and an excellent angler from what I understand, but I think the statement that there's not any fish back on the Rogue River is simply not the case. The past 10-year average for fall chinook was 30,000 fall chinook returning. That's the 10-year average. 200,000 to 50,000 half-pounders, which are essentially steelhead that go out to the estuary of the ocean and come right back in the same year. And that supports a very robust guided fishery on the river during the summer months, summer and fall. Anywhere from 10 to 50,000 summer steelhead. Now, this doesn't even talk about the winter steelhead, which could be, or the coho in this river. The spring chinook are a problem, and I think that everybody up here has talked about the problem for spring chinook on the Rogue is Lost Creek Dam. They put out over a million smolts, and there's about a 5% return for those fish. Steve mentioned that the runs of spring chinook are very low right now, but even they've been higher. 1999 to 2004, when there was good ocean conditions, there were quite a bit more spring chinook coming back to the Rogue River. These numbers go up and down for a lot of reasons.
David, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Certainly.
On page two, and we've got to wrap up because we have one more person who wants to testify, and we've got to be out of here in 5 minutes. As far as, or you probably know the answer to this, as far as the water release scheme that you've mentioned from the Army Corps of Engineers, is that for temperature? Is that for, you know, what's the purpose of that change in the release?
I'm not an expert on the releases, but I do know that the authorization, the federal authorization for this dam, provided for flood control, water for municipalities and irrigation, hydropower, and for fish. It's one of the only projects in the country that actually has a authorization to manage the river for fish by letting water go down. Because what happens, these fall shank are coming up, and the river is very warm, and the Corps has to release cold water to trigger that migration up into the upper part of the river. I would say that, I think you should talk to the department about the specifics here, but what they're it's creating this early emergence. The water's warmer, so it triggers the eggs to grow into the little guys faster. And they go out. Essentially, they're going to middle school with an elementary school body is what's going on. And they're not ready for it. And so there's low survival.
Okay. So if you can wrap up, David.
Certainly. I'm glad that Senator Boquist is back because I just want to make light of my last point, and that is, you know, a river is like a field. It has a capacity, a carrying capacity. You can't just go aim for extraordinary numbers, as the proponents of this proposal say they want to achieve, extraordinary numbers. If you over-fertilize or over-water, you're not going to get the returns. So this is it's a fine balance. And let me just say that the intent of the proponents to want to help the river is genuine and good, and it's shared by the local chapter of Trout Unlimited, by the steelheaders, by the fly fishermen. Everybody wants more fish. We're back to our returns of large numbers of fish to this river. And this is born out of good intent. But nothing that we do can be as effective as a natural river that's running, that's healthy. And this project is simply going to interfere with trying to get at the real problems of this river.
All right, thank you, David. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay, with that, you are released. Couldn't resist that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have questions.
So am I. I had lots of questions and several statements, but we'll just go on.
Okay, so the last person anybody else that didn't sign up that would like to testify, I think Lorna Walker wanted to come up.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask you to be brief because we've got about 2 minutes left.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Lorna Walker, and I was listening and observing the process involved here, the hatchbox concept is a newer concept to me, but as I was listening, I was thinking of the science benchmarks, the investigative process in science, the value of student involvement, of hands-on experiences in applying their knowledge of science and mathematics. Raised a few questions, maintenance, timing, haven't seen the hatch box. Can you put the parts in a dishwasher for sterilizing before you reuse it? Storage for the hatch box. Is this something whereby it would be suitable in various areas of the state with the suitable life for that particular area to do a science team in service of elementary, middle, and high school to give students an opportunity to do the project, monitor it, learn how to log it, to make their scientific recording and observations, and how frequently can you do this during the year? Can you do it only 2 times during the year? How long does the process take? What is the period of time from the germination of those eggs to their... What's the time frame that the teacher has in working with this batch of eggs, getting them from putting them in the hatch box into the water? Is it all done right on site in the water? all kinds of questions come up. It sounds like an exciting opportunity that really could be useful and helpful in restocking throughout the state and offer a wonderful opportunity for science involvement with students across the spectrum.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
No, I would just encourage you to talk to these gentlemen because I'm sure they can answer all your questions. So with that, unless anybody else would like to testify, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 472. Thank you all for whoever came here to testify today. Appreciate that, and I'm sure we'll be having some more discussions on this bill. Just want to thank the committee for their attention and to alert you that Tuesday is also Fisheries Day. We have several fisheries bills as well, so we'll look forward to some more discussions on that. With that, I will close the committee hearing. Senate.